welcome to Pints with Treebeard. I'm Jameson Winter. I'm the dean of the upper school here at Augustine School in Jackson, Tennessee. And today I'm joined by Josh Edgren.
I'm Josh Edgren. I'm a pastor and teacher in Moscow, Idaho. Jameson, what's the topic of the day? What are we doing?
Today we're going to revisit Lord of the Rings and look at the character of Boromir. So as we work through different portions of this book, we'll focus on characters and scenes and particular themes. And we want to start with several of the characters just because there's so much richness there in focusing not just on the story as a whole or an event, but really diving deep into one person. And maybe particularly for Boromir, why would we start here and not with one of the other bigger names of the Fellowship? I think one, just because he's a really great character. And two, alongside that, he's not a character that many people know about, at least not if they haven't read the books and meditated on him. Even if you've read the book, you probably, if you've only read it once, maybe twice, didn't think much about Boromir, except for his couple of big scenes at the Council of Elrond and then at his death. But you probably haven't thought much about what we actually learn from Boromir and what are his virtues and the good qualities that we should imitate from Boromir. So we want to focus on that. And then maybe just here at the beginning to kind of clear his name, because the movies with many characters and with many points of the plot, the movies take not just kind of some creative license, but actually change the story in fundamental ways. And Boromir, more than most, not maybe more than everyone, but more than most, is utterly different in the movie versus the book. Some of the same things happen, and you get little glimpses of his flaw in the movie, but that's really all you get, is you just see the flaw that we see clear as day in the book with Boromir, but you get very little, I would say, of the virtue. And so we want to take some time to explore that together, think through it, and yeah, hopefully just help people to understand that Boromir is a good guy, not a bad guy.
Yeah, agreed. I might say that you go too far and say that he's utterly different in the movies, but he's presented much more two-dimensionally in the movies than he is in the books. And to your point, what's largely left out are his virtues. Whereas in the movie, you see, oh, he's, you know, kind of a bad guy, right? Like, and he's a bad guy whose badness has to come out over time, but he's essentially corrupted, and that's what you get. And when you read the books, you realize, no, he's actually more complicated than that. He's more of a tragic hero than a villain, but not a true tragic hero, because he's redeemed. So it's good stuff with Boromir, and we have much to learn. So where do you want to start? Where do you want to give a background for him, or just say where the hobbits find him? What do you want to do?
Yeah, I think the first thing that I would want to say about Boromir that we miss in the movies in particular that we get in the book is just the recognition that he's a good man. So you don't really know much about his background in the movie because obviously they don't have time for that. But in the book, in the Council of Elrond, when they meet him, you actually get some exposition from him and from others underlining things that you don't know to this point if you don't know the story, which is that Gondor and Minas Tirith in particular is on the edge of Mordor, and that the men of Gondor, and Boromir is one of their chief captains, have been fighting against Mordor and holding them back from taking over the free peoples of Middle-earth. And they've been doing this great work generation after generation after generation. And Boromir even says, you know, you can sense some kind of weariness, I think, and maybe a little bit of bitterness as well. He alludes to the fact that they fight these battles and they sacrifice themselves for the sake of people who don't give them thanks oftentimes. And he, I think, is lamenting that legitimately. It's probably also part of what wounds him and makes him hesitant to even ask for help. He comes into the Council of Elrond and gives this account of a dream that he's had that has led him to Rivendell, and he says he has come so that Gondor might receive aid, but he's not seeking an army. He's not seeking Elrond to send out his sons, the elf lords, and to help them in the physical fight. He's seeking wisdom and counsel, and he alludes to the fact that he has been on this journey for over 100 days seeking an interpretation of this dream that Faramir has had, his brother, a number of times, and that he has also now had. And it talks about, we don't have to go into all the details here maybe, but it talks about Isildur's bane being found and this halfling and a sword that is broken and these other things. So that's where we get introduced to Boromir. He's seeking for an interpretation of a dream, and he then gets exposed to the fact that, okay, we have Isildur's bane. It's been found. He now can identify Isildur's bane as Sauron's ring, and he gets looped into the quest to take the ring to Mount Doom, at least insofar as his path lies on their path. Because from the beginning, his plan is to go back to Gondor with Aragorn, and eventually... obviously things go differently for both of them, but that's their intent, is to set out with Frodo and protect him and help him up until the point that he has to cross the Anduin and they have to go back to Minas Tirith to help with the fight.
Really interesting thing that is often missed is and we've talked about before the theme of providence in The Lord of the Rings, but it strikes me again, thinking about Boromir, he doesn't come to the Council of Elrond to participate in the Council of Elrond. He comes for, as you say, interpretation of a dream. And is just sort of drawn in to this quest that he didn't know anything about, but where did this dream come from, right? Why is this dream given to Faramir and then also to him? It does come to him as well. He's being drawn into this thing that is bigger than him, and he's being drawn in for what purpose, right? So I'd love to have us kind of think about that as we go on. Like, what is the divine purpose of Boromir being drawn into the quest? So what's the significance there? We don't answer it right now, but let's have that be playing in all that follows. Why? Why is Providence drawing Boromir into the quest? And then just a couple of thoughts on the situation in Gondor. How long, you said generations, how long has Gondor been holding out against Mordor? And what's the story there? As far as I understand it, Mordor was like the prison where Sauron was condemned, or maybe after he falls in the Battle of the Last Alliance and his spirit is gone, that's when, you know, the men of Gondor build these fortresses and these castles around Mordor to keep the bad stuff in. So, you know, Minas Morgul was before, Minas Ithil, Tower of the Moon, right? And that was a fortress that was meant to keep the bad stuff in. So that's the beginning of the Third Age. We're now, 3,000 years into the Third Age? So for 3,000 years, the men of Gondor, to one extent or another, have been vigilant or waging active war against Mordor. But things change when the Necromancer comes back to Mordor, right, approximately 60 years before the events of The Lord of the Rings. And tied up with Bilbo and the Hobbit and the quest, right? And I would imagine that in the last several decades leading up to this, the Council of Elrond, so for most of Boromir's life, there have been active wars with orcs and stuff as new powers rising in Mordor. Probably kind of freaky, but it has been 3,000 years of vigilance.
Yeah, that's right. And it's interesting to note the reality for Boromir, and this is something I try to impress upon my students, to understand his character, you have to understand that not only have his people been fighting against Sauron for 3,000 years, right? So there's a roughly 3,000 year gap between Isildur taking the ring and dying with it and Aragorn ascending to the throne. So not only do you have that context, and you have this long kind of, I mean, it's almost impossible to imagine. Imagine living in a country, living in a city for that matter, that has to some extent been at war for 3,000 years. Like, is there such a city? Like, maybe you could kind of count Jerusalem, I guess. But even there, it's so many different wars with so many different peoples. It's not like one single sustained conflict with Mordor right on your border. So even there, it's very different. It's hard to even, I think, imagine as people what that would do to a culture. And sure, you've been, in some sense, victorious for 3,000 years. It's not like you've been totally oppressed and taken over and occupied by orcs. That's not what's happening. But still, the kind of mindset that that creates in your culture is just staggering to consider. But then we also talk about, okay, he is, you know, a young to middle-aged man, and all he has known his whole life is being at war. And like you said, all he has known is being at war in this way after the necromancer has returned to Mordor. And so that likely means a great deal of activity compared to, you know, the previous 100 or 200 or 300 years, or even further back. You know, there are spurts here and there. We don't have a whole ton of information on that time period, but certainly he is gaining power for all of Boromir's life and had been gaining power before Boromir is born. And to be in that mindset, I mean, imagine being a boy born in Troy, and by the time you're 9 years old, you realize, huh, since I've been born, we've had Achaeans on our shores trying to take over and burn our city. Like, it's not the same, but there is a similarity there between those two mindsets. Like, put yourself in the shoes of that boy. And so I think if we don't get that, we won't get some of, maybe most of, Boromir's virtue, which is why I spoke so strongly about the movie, because we just don't understand that. From the movie's perspective, we don't understand, because they don't give the time to it in the Council of Elrond, that it's been that long, and that the men of Gondor have been the lone bulwark in the south, with the assistance of Rohan, of course, in holding Mordor at bay. And that is less clear, which I think leads us to very quickly move past some important characteristics of Boromir and his life, and understanding why his virtue is so virtuous.
Yeah, and on that note, I'd like to just read a little bit of kind of Boromir's introduction of himself. So he's introduced briefly by Elrond, saying, this is Boromir, he's from the south. Then Elrond gives that long history that we kind of summarized there. But this is what Boromir says, and I think this is central to who he is. So Elrond ceased, but at once Boromir stood up, tall and proud, before them. Give me leave, Master Elrond, said he, first to say more of Gondor, for verily from the land of Gondor I am come. And it would be well for all to know what passes there, for few, I deem, know of our deeds, and therefore guess little of their peril, if we should fail at last. Believe not that in the land of Gondor the blood of Numenor is spent, nor all its pride and dignity forgotten. By our valor, the wild men of the East are still restrained, and the terror of Morgul kept at bay, and thus alone are peace and freedom maintained in the lands behind us, bulwark of the West. But if the passages of the river should be won, what then? And then he goes on and talks about how this, you know, this nameless evil has spread. There's been sudden war just in the last few months. He says, only a remnant of our eastern force came back, destroying the last bridge that still stood amid the ruins of Osgiliath. And this is great. I was in the company that held the bridge until it was cast down behind us. Four only were saved by swimming, my brother and myself and two others. But still we fight on, holding all the west shores of Anduin. And those who shelter behind us give us praise, if ever they hear our name. Much praise, but little help. Only from Rohan now will any man ride to us when we call. So we're given this description of Boromir as a man of great personal courage. He's a valiant man. He is persistent in his fight. He's a captain of men. And you do get, like you said, this slight bitterness that no one comes to help us anymore. We're the last. We're holding out. But all the pride and dignity of Numenor is not lost and forgotten. We are still who we once were, which is not true, interestingly enough. There's two things about that. One, Elrond has already described that the blood of Numenor has been diluted, that actually Numenor is not been preserved. But what's interesting is Gandalf will say this later, and this is so important for Boromir. Gandalf will tell Pippin this later, when he's talking about Denethor, Boromir's father, and he'll say, by some coincidence, the blood of Numenor runs true in Denethor. Denethor is would have fit in Numenor. And so would his other son, Faramir. Faramir also would have been able to look eye to eye with the Numenorians of the Second Age, but not Boromir. So there's this beautiful and tragic irony in Boromir saying, the blood of Numenor is not spent. Right? He's trying to hold on to this lost past, when he himself actually doesn't have it in some undefinable way. And we'll see as we go on what that means. But that's that's how Boromir presents himself. We see his pride, his love of country, his love of his people, his pride in his place and love of country.
One of the most interesting things about his character is that you have our two, in English vernacular, our two uses of the word pride. You see the virtue and the vice in Boromir very clearly. And I try to help our students to distinguish between those two things as he's talking. So we'll look at many of the words that he says and just say, okay, this paragraph, how is he using the word pride, or how does Tolkien use the word pride to describe him here? Is this the virtue or is this the vice? Because you see the vice very clearly, particularly as he continues to more and more say things about how, you know, he could use the ring, or the men of the West could use the ring to defeat Sauron. They wouldn't be corrupted by it, that sort of thing. But you also see the virtue, which is his love of country and his pride, not merely in himself, but in his people and the good work that they are doing. So it's the difference between conceit and arrogance and pride as a vice, and being proud of a job well done, and being proud to be a part of a job well done. And I mean, even the passage that you read is just so perfect in illustrating that. Like, he and his brother and these two others were part of the party that said, we're going to stay here and hold the bridge while you destroy it behind us. And then if we can, we'll get back to the safe side of the river and we'll help you. But obviously they're going to assume that they can't. Like, almost all of them die. And the fact that the two of them as the steward's sons were willing to lead that charge is just incredible.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. Yeah, going on, a key part of Boromir's character is the relationship he has to Aragorn, and how that changes over time, because you have this contrast. Boromir is this representative of the men of the West. He's talking about how great they are and how important their work is, and boy, they need help, but they never get it. But we're not here to ask for help, but you know, if you wanted to help, that'd be great. So there is this pride, but also courage and nobility, contrasted with Aragorn, who they meet in The Prancing Pony as a ranger. And he does not look like he is the king, and yet he is. And in him will actually that pride and glory of Numenor be restored, but it doesn't look like it. So they're contrasted. And we see that in Boromir's words. He says, here is the sword that was broken, he said. And who are you? And what have you to do with Minas Tirith? Asked Boromir, looking in wonder at the lean face of the ranger and his weather-stained cloak. Right. So then we see the pride of Boromir in the negative, that he is. He says, What do you have to offer us? What do you have to do with Minas Tirith, you ranger from the north? And then once Elrond explains who Aragorn is, then Boromir understands. But even still, he's skeptical. Now, how long would you say, or I don't know, tell me what your thoughts on his skepticism towards Aragorn.
Yeah, it's, again, an interesting thing in the book because it's more complex. It is, you already alluded to this, but just later on this page that you were reading from, he says, I was not sent to beg any boon, but to seek only the meaning of a riddle, answered Boromir proudly. Right. So again, there's, I think, even a mix maybe of the two uses of pride there intentionally, but that's but we don't maybe have time to go into it. Yet we are hard pressed, and the sword of Elendil would be a help beyond our hope if such a thing could indeed return out of the shadows of the past. He looked again at Aragorn, and doubt was in his eyes. So I guess it kind of depends on how you read exchanges like this. I read those very sympathetically to Boromir, because I think of who he is as a great man. He's been long-suffering, enduring this battle on the front lines, willing to sacrifice himself for the cause, all of these sorts of things. My thought about how would he look at Aragorn, and how should I read these words on the page? Should I read his doubt as animosity, or his doubt as simple lack of faith and hope? And I take it as the latter, whereas I think the movies portray it as the former. He's very skeptical and like arrogant in the sense that he thinks he's better than Aragorn. But you don't get this kind of complexity where you see, okay, he actually does want the Sword of Elendil to return. He says it would be a help beyond their hope. And I think he has very little hope at this point that Aragorn is the king who will return and help restore the kingdom and fight off Sauron. But even by the time they're leaving Rivendell, you see, actually even later in this conversation, I believe, you see Boromir coming around and longing to put Aragorn to the test in a positive sense. He says, you know, who knows what will happen if the Sword of Elendil returns, and maybe we will if this weapon is able, you know, to be wielded. Oh, what does he say? He says, you know, if you have inherited the sinews of Isildur and not an heirloom only, then maybe we will be able to hold Sauron off. Right. So he's, again, starting to come around, even within this conversation, to the idea that I actually do want Aragorn to be Elendil's heir. I do want the sword to be reforged, which is just not the same kind of picture that we get in the films, unfortunately, because it shows you that he wants Aragorn to be a great man and to help deliver them.
No, I think that's right. And we said before we started recording that we weren't going to rag on the movies too much, but it's atrocious in some respects. What do they have him say in the movie? Like, Gondor has no king. Gondor needs no king. And there's like this, we're better off without you, which is just stupid. And not at all who Boromir is in the book. I think you're exactly right. There's no animosity, but there's doubt, right? He says, I don't think you are actually the king. But if you are, well, then fantastic, right? And we see him come around in the end. And Aragorn is gracious with him. And he says, I forgive your doubt, right? Little do I resemble the figures of Elendil and Isildur. And then I agree with you that he wants his questions answered honestly. He really does. And that's consistent with what we've seen. Like, it's been a long time. It's been a long fight. Just all of a sudden now, the sword that was broken being reforged, like, that's too good to be true. It's too good to be true. We've been waiting all this time, and now? So it's a hardened, I don't know, the flip side of the patience, right? They've been a long-suffering people, but that can make them skeptical.
Yeah, and it's hard for them to continue in hope because it's been so long. It's hard to continue in hope that, think about, again, the fact that, okay, your country's been at war for 3,000 years. Also, you haven't had a king for 3,000 years. And there's this kind of hinted idea that a king will come back someday, and we're still continuing with the line of stewards for that purpose. But really, is there any hope left that Elendil's line has not just died out? You would probably think no, if you were just a citizen of Gondor, even if you're of the steward's household. You'd probably think, well, you know, we've been sitting on the steward's seat in Gondor longer even than there was a king before us. So, you know, this is essentially just the way of the world now. You see, I think, like you said, his genuine, honest questions, his honest doubt about Aragorn. But I do think he comes around on that, and you see him grow in his respect for Aragorn, which just makes the final scene between the two of them that much richer and fuller. So maybe we can take just a few minutes to walk through some of, I think, his chief virtues, because this is what you miss if you aren't meditating on who he is as a man while you read the book. It's very easy, because he doesn't have that much dialogue and it's not that important for much of what he says, to just kind of brush over it. But if you actually pick apart his words at times, I think you get a sense of the man, and it shows a great picture of someone who is, as we already mentioned, long-suffering, right? He's been enduring this battle himself that his people have been enduring. And maybe a caveat there, I think all of his virtues are virtues of Gondor, and Tolkien is using him intentionally as at least a partial representative of the realm of Gondor. That for him to be long-suffering shows that his people are long-suffering. That is also true in large part, I think, of his vice, in particular of pride. And yet that part is less true, at least, of the men of Numenor, at least the true men of Numenor, right? Because then you could even go into, there's some of this in Isildur. Maybe it's not there in Elendil. There's some of this kind of pride in Denethor, who is almost, you know, the blood runs almost true in him. It's not there in Aragorn. So even within Numenor, there's like a true Numenorean spirit, I think, that Tolkien wants us to take away which is essentially who Aragorn is. But Boromir does represent Gondor as it is, in part, and kind of the vestiges of I guess, the men of the West, so to speak, as they've dwindled down and the blood has been diluted, so to speak. So obviously long suffering. He's obviously courageous and a great warrior. I love the line when they're leaving Rivendell, where he blows this great blast on his horn, and Gandalf says, or Aragorn, one of the two of them says, you know, that he should be very cautious to blow that horn again until he's well within the bounds of his own land. And he says, I always blow this horn when I set out, and I will not go forth as a thief in the night, right? So there's maybe some brashness there, some foolhardiness there to some degree. So Boromir is clearly going to fight you face to face, right? He's an honorable warrior. What else do you see in him?
Yeah, so he's an interesting mix of the hope and the lack of hope, the hope and the doubt. I just want to back up for a second that they're talking about what to do with the ring, and they're talking about, and if we do such and such, then this will happen. If we do such and such, then this will happen. Basically, if we do anything but destroy the ring, eventually Sauron will just crush us all. And Boromir says, you know, long yet will that march be delayed. Gondor wanes, you say, but Gondor stands, and even the end of its strength is still very strong. So there's this courage, this undauntedness, and this hope in his own abilities, this confidence in his own strength that you see again and again, which is related to his pride. But again, that is not a bad thing. To be confident in one's own abilities is not inherently bad. It's when one is overly confident in one's own abilities to the exclusion of wisdom. So he's willing to spend himself. He's willing for Gondor to spend and be spent. He's willing to, you have in your notes, that wonderful bit when they're, you know, I don't want to jump too far ahead, but that wonderful bit when they're trying to cross Caradhras and they've just got to shove their way through the snow, and he's willing to put his body on the line to just to shoulder his way through, it's specifically described that he's like wading through with his great arms, pushing the snow out of the way to make a path for the hobbits. So that's just a beautiful picture of his strength, his courage, his just, you know, dogged persistence, his willingness to literally put his body on the line for the good of his people. I think that's lovely.
I think to follow up on that, one of the things I love most about the scene on Carathras is that he gives good counsel to Gandalf, and he does it twice. So before they go up the mountain, they know that they need to remain secret, but he says, I've grown up under the shadow of a white mountain like this, essentially, and we need to take wood with us to make fire. And so Gandalf, he's not reluctant, I don't think. I just read this recently. But you get this sense that he thinks, okay, we should do this. That is wise. That is prudent. Although Gandalf is very opposed to them making a fire at all costs. And he says as much. He says, you know, we should take the wood, but only use it if it is a matter between fire and death, right? If no fire means we die, then we can start a fire. Otherwise, we can't, because he doesn't want them to be spotted by the spies of the enemy and assailed, particularly while they're on the mountain. But then when they're on the mountain, he's pleading with Gandalf, we have to do something else. We have to get out of here. This is going to be the death of the halfling. And yeah,
that's a scene that the movie captures perfectly. That's right. It's great.
And he's legitimately concerned for them, right? He's legitimately concerned that this will be hopeless if we continue, because who is he? He is the wartime kind of strategist, right? He understands how to get men through a hard spot. And so he gives good counsel there and says, look, we've got to start the fire or we will die. And nobody will know where we are. And that'll do us a lot of good when we're all covered with snow. I mean, he essentially says that, not quite word for word, but that's the exact idea that he uses. And Gandalf takes that and accepts it as good counsel. And so they start a fire. Gandalf actually has to be the one to start the fire. And then he says, you know, everybody here from the mouth of Anduin to Rivendell will know Gandalf is on this mountain, right, Gandalf is here. I've just lit a sign that shows, because it's this, you know, magical blue and green fire.
Yeah, I just want to read that bit, because it captures him again in a wonderful way. He says, after they've pushed their way, he says, before, when heads are at a loss, bodies must serve, as we say in my country. The strongest of us must seek a way. And that's key to who Boromir is. He's always about strength. He's always about the strong doing what they can, right? Which ultimately is what causes him to fall to the Lord of the Ring later.
Really quickly, one thing on that point is the strong must do what they can for the good of those who can't, right? He's always subjecting that strength to the good of those whom he's leading. And so it's important just to note, because you could get the wrong idea there that he's just, you know, survival of the fittest and all of this, but he understands his place as a steward and as a commander of men, that he wants to be the first one in because he trusts in his strength and in Aragorn's strength as they go and, you know, shovel the snow in this case, to provide a way for the weak to come after him. So even his motivation for the ring is to provide a way for the weak who can't overthrow Sauron to overthrow Sauron.
No, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. Yeah. But then later, after they come back, he says, happily, your Caradhras has forgotten that you have men with you, said Boromir, who came up at that moment, and doughty men too, if I may say it. And then there's this great, though lesser men with spades might have served you better, which is just a wonderful, like, it's a great bit of self-deprecating humor. Like, here we are with all of our strength. Actually, I'd prefer a couple of teenagers with some shovels. That would have been better. Still, we have thrust a lane through the ditch, and for all that here may be, and for that all here may be grateful, who cannot run as light as elves. And then Pippin says, I don't know, how can we get across? And Boromir says, have hope. I am weary, but I still have some strength left. And Aragorn, too. We shall bear the little folk. So that's, again, that captures him wonderfully. He's using his strength, willing to spend and be spent for the sake of the little folk. But there is this, you know, me first. I'm going to go do it. I can do it. And we see his character there.
I think one last thing to mention that we haven't covered as much is his loyalty and his sense of belonging, not only to Gondor, which is obvious. It just, you see his loyalty in everything that he says, but it's also his loyalty to others whom he knows are virtuous. So he says, for instance, when they're getting the story from Gandalf that Gandalf has taken Shadowfax from Rohan and ridden back to try to find Frodo, you get a word before that at some point, I think from Gimli or Gloin, about the rumor of the men of Rohan paying tribute to Sauron with their horses. Aragorn says, then he, meaning Shadowfax, must be a noble beast indeed, and it grieves me more than many tidings that might seem worse to learn that Sauron levies such tribute, i.e., that he levies such tribute from Rohan, great horses like this. And then Aragorn says, it was not so when I was last in that land. Boromir chimes in here and interrupts and says, nor is it so now, I will swear. It is a lie that comes from the enemy. I know the men of Rohan, true and valiant, our allies, dwelling still in the lands that we gave them long ago. And Aragorn comes back and says, the shadow of Mordor lies on distant lands. Saruman has fallen under it. Rohan is beset. Who knows what you will find there if ever you return? And then Boromir finally has his last reply. Not this at least, that they will buy their lives with horses. They love their horses next to their kin, and not without reason, for the horses of the Ridamark come from the fields of the north, far from the shadow, and their race, as that of their masters, is descended from the free days of old. And I just love that moment, because again, it shows that he is willing to fight for what's true and fight for the goodness of the men of Rohan and defend them even against Aragorn. It's not the only time that he kind of contradicts or pushes against Aragorn or Gandalf, as we just saw with the wood and the need for a fire on the mountain. And he's proven correct. He's proven true and right. And this is one of those moments that, again, you miss these little things if you're not focused on who he is and what kind of man he is. So yeah, his loyalty to goodness and to the ideas of faithfulness and friends and companions and allies remaining true against the darkness. He's not quickly going to believe that people would leave and desert him, or leave and desert Gondor, or whatever it is, right? He believes in the principle of holding fast to the good.
Yeah, a couple of things. One, it's interesting his quickness to defend Rohan. If you cross-reference that with him being a man of Gondor who does not have the blood of Westerness, that makes him akin to the men of Rohan in a way. They're often compared, like the men of Gondor who are not of Numenorean, you know, descent or not of Numenorean quality are like the men of Rohan. And so it's interesting seeing this affinity between Boromir and the men of Rohan. And there's parallels there that are strong. You know, so in some ways, Boromir's corresponding figure is not Faramir, his brother, but Éomer, in a way. And you see, in some senses, Éomer become what Boromir could have been. Not that he was put in the same circumstances, but you see that brotherhood between Aragorn and Éomer that is what brotherhood there could have been with Boromir. So it's just interesting.
And to make that connection even stronger, I had not considered this, but you have the, in some sense, the fault of the people of Rohan and of Éomer is this kind of battle lust and this desire for glory in battle that goes beyond reason. It's not that that is a bad thing. It's actually portrayed as a good thing by and large by Tolkien. I mean, he's a classicist. He understands the need for that kind of fervor in battle and a desire to fight valiantly, to die valiantly, all of that, to bring renown and glory and acclaim upon your name for the way that you fought and sacrificed yourself. Those are good things to Tolkien, and he's showing us that. But Faramir, in the Houses of Healing, when he's talking with Eowyn, he says, "I do not love the blade for its sharpness." And he says, "I love only that which it defends." So his point there is, I don't seek glory in the same way that Boromir, his brother, does, or that the men of Rohan do. I seek only to defend. So he sees war here as a necessity, and I want to do my part and command men, and he's obviously a man of courage as well, there on the bridge with Boromir, as we've already alluded to. But he sees that as a means to the end of delighting in life. And that's why he and Eowyn are such a fitting and poetic couple at the end, because, yeah, well, we'll get to that later. We'll do episodes on both of them. But it does make that connection strong that you're mentioning, that Boromir is more like the men of Rohan in that desire for glory in battle, and Faramir is more like the men of the West who understand it rightly and walk in it well, but don't go too far.
Yeah, and that's why Faramir needs to marry Éowyn. Yeah, because she needs to be healed. Yeah, good, good, good. I hate to do this, but I really think we gotta move on. And we need to get to his pivotal scene with Frodo, up on Amon Hen. Just briefly, he shows great courage in the battles with wolves and the battles with the goblins in Moria. Although he's skeptical of Gandalf's leadership in Moria, like, who will lead us down here? Interestingly, I never noticed this before. Contra the movies, Boromir's the one that throws the rock into the pool and kind of arouses the Watcher, which is just really interesting. And Frodo kind of rebukes him and says, like, why'd you do that? That was dumb. So you can see this kind of this brashness again a little bit. Going on, he doesn't have a lot in Lothlorien, but you do get the sense that he's kind of changed after Lothlorien. He then is helpful in rowing the boats up the Great River, but you're starting to get this sense that Boromir's not doing well. Merry and Pippin in the middle boat were ill at ease, for Boromir sat muttering to himself, sometimes biting his nails, as if some restlessness or doubt consumed him, sometimes seizing a paddle and driving the boat close behind Aragorn's, where Frodo is. Right. And then Pippin, who sat in the bow looking back, caught a queer gleam in his eye as he peered forward, gazing at Frodo. So you're getting the sense that, like, okay, there's something eating at Boromir. What's going on? And then it all comes to a head in the last chapter of The Fellowship of the Ring, the breaking of the Fellowship. But yeah, thoughts on that summary or anything that I missed you want to add?
No, I think that's right. If anything, I would just say that it is more subdued, I think, than the movies. And that's obviously because of the different mediums, because Tolkien can hint at what they have to show clearly on the screen. So that's the one part that actually, ironically, maybe I don't fault them for, you know, that you have to show it more clearly in the movie for it to be expected. I don't fault them for showing that clearly. I just think they start there at like an 8 and turn it up to a 10 rather than starting at like a 3 and going up to a 10. But no, I think you're right. Then we come to this scene where Frodo's gone off to be by himself to think about what they're going to do and how they're going to proceed and whether he goes to Minas Tirith. And Boromir comes up to him, and that's where they have the exchange.
So at this point, Frodo's trying to decide what to do. Gandalf has fallen, so he can't lead them. And what Frodo is realizing is that he's got to go to Mordor. Like, that's what it comes to, which is what they decided to do in the Council of Elrond. But there's been some doubt, and obviously things have gone badly, and, you know, Gandalf's fall has thrown everything off. But at the end of the day, the logic that they pounded out at the Council of Elrond hasn't changed. It's still the same logic, which is we're not going to win by strength. We've got to win by weakness. But Boromir doesn't get that, and he never did. He never was persuaded. He was just submissive. And now Gandalf's gone, and Boromir's hunger for this strength that he thinks he can use to defend his people is there. And so Frodo says, you know, there's no hope. There's no hope while the ring lasts. And Boromir basically says, no. It's the other way. Like, the ring is what's giving us hope. So this element of hope there, where is Boromir placing his hope? He has hope in certain things, but not in other things. What do you think about that?
No, I think that's exactly right. You see him say, this is on 398 for me. He says in the middle of a large paragraph, essentially trying to show Frodo that you're only saying this, you're only saying we can't use it, and that everything it does is turned to evil, because that's what you've been taught to say by Gandalf and Elrond. And he says, we of Minas Tirith have been staunch through long years of trial. We do not desire the power of wizard lords, only strength to defend ourselves, strength in a just cause. And behold, in our need, chance brings to light the Ring of Power. It is a gift, I say, a gift to the foes of Mordor. It is mad not to use it, to use the power of the enemy against him. The fearless, the ruthless, these alone will achieve victory. What could not a warrior do in this hour, a great leader? What could not Aragorn do? Or, if he refuses, why not Boromir? The ring would give me power to command. How I would drive the hosts of Mordor, and all men would flock to my banner. So I think you see, obviously, the ring drawing out this pride and this kind of desire for power, and not power for its own sake, but power to do the right thing. But you see that desire coming out of him. I, again, read this sympathetically. I think he really believes Aragorn, it would be acceptable for Boromir if Aragorn took the ring and fought against Sauron. I also think at the same time, he says, rightly, he's alluding to the fact that he knows Aragorn is not going to take the ring. And so why not me, right? But I do take Boromir at his word there, even though the ring is obviously corrupting him and coming over him in a way that we see even a couple of pages later. He realizes he's been affected by the ring in his desires and his words. And it's not possessing him, so to speak. That would be maybe putting it crudely. But it is shaping what he's saying.
And this is so important for our understanding of the ring, exactly this point that you're getting at. The ring doesn't introduce false or alien ideas. The ring takes what you are and makes it more so, but bad, right? So the ring tempts according to what each person is. And so just like ideally, and I think it's wonderful because ideally, you know, what the gospel does, what the Spirit of God does is make us more what we are for good, more what we are for glory. But Tolkien is presenting this the other way. Is the ring draws out what we are and makes us more that to our destruction, right? More of what we are, but bad. So what we see in that next paragraph, this is great. Boromir strode up and down, speaking ever more loudly. Almost he seemed to have forgotten Frodo, while his talk dwelt on walls and weapons and the mustering of men, and he drew plans for great alliances and glorious victories to be, and he cast down Mordor and became himself a mighty king, benevolent and wise. Right. So he's, this is what he wants. This is what in some ways he's made to be, in some ways. But what the ring is calling out of him is this ambition, this glory, but particularly a martial glory, that for him, he wants those wars and the walls and the weapons and the alliances, all right? He wants the power, right? And what we can easily see with Boromir is that it begins with him wanting power to defend his people, and where it ends is him wanting power for himself. And this is such a sharp contrast with Faramir. It's almost breathtaking that Faramir says, I wouldn't use that to defend my people. I wouldn't, because I understand what it is, and that some causes aren't worth that, right? Some causes don't justify the doing of evil, and I understand what this thing is and what it does. And it would begin one way, but it would end another way. And like Gandalf says, it would work on me in pity. I would begin with a desire to do good, but it would corrupt my very doing of good.
I love that line from Faramir. So I'll read it here because he's talking to Frodo about the ring and trying to assure him that he doesn't want to take the ring and he doesn't want to take Frodo to Minas Tirith. He says, but fear no more. I would not take this thing if it lay by the highway, not were Minas Tirith falling in ruin and I alone could save her. So using the weapon of the Dark Lord for her good and my glory. No, I do not wish for such triumphs, Frodo, son of Drogo. Which you just see very clearly, like you said, that is the absolute opposite of what we just see in Boromir here when he tries to take the ring. He tries to take the ring thinking, I do want the glory. I do want to use the weapon of the enemy against him. That is worth the cost, worth the risk. In fact, he doesn't even see it as a cost. He sees it as the only sane thing to do, which is maybe, again, an important point to come back to that you've already mentioned. His mindset is that the strong need to do whatever they have to do to protect the weak. And that's a good principle by itself. But that means he sees no hope. He sees no future where they could possibly take the ring into Mordor that doesn't end in Sauron getting the ring. That's something else that the students, they kind of struggle with a little bit when they get to this part. We're actually talking about it now in class this week. They struggle to realize, sometimes at least, just reading for themselves, oh, he has a legitimate point here. Their hope of Frodo taking the ring into Mordor is crazy because essentially everything that can go wrong will go wrong, and that's probably just going to end in Sauron getting the ring. But he doesn't see, even like you alluded to at the beginning, he doesn't see the divine providence here, that this is actually the whole plan from the beginning.
No, that's right. That's right. And something I never noticed before, going back to the quote from Faramir, I never noticed that the two quotes we've given from Faramir are in the same paragraph. Because, and this is key, Boromir thinks strong must do what they can, whatever they can, to protect the weak. What he doesn't recognize is that some of the things that the strong do to protect the weak end up destroying the weak. And so what Faramir says is, I do not wish for such triumphs, right? What he means by that is, I don't wish for the triumphs over Mordor that would end up destroying Minas Tirith in the end anyways. He says, oh, it's wonderful. So for myself, said Faramir, I would see the white tree in flower again in the courts of the kings, and the silver crown return, and Minas Tirith in peace, Minas Arnor again as of old, full of light, high and fair, beautiful as a queen among other queens, not as a mistress of many slaves. Nay, not even a kind mistress of willing slaves. He says, I want it restored, but I know that if she fights Mordor with the weapons of Mordor, she becomes Mordor. And I'm unwilling. I would rather have her perish than have her become evil. I would rather have her perish than and be remembered in story or in song, be worthy of remembering, than become Charn, than become wicked. And that's what Boromir doesn't get. He lacks the wisdom. He lacks the subtleness. He lacks the far-sightedness that marks Faramir, that marks Gandalf, Aragorn. Denethor, to an extent, right? You see that subtlety in and that wisdom in Denethor as well. And we should probably do a whole episode on Denethor, too, because he's also a tragic figure in a lot of ways. But Boromir is so focused on strength that he fails to see what strength does when it's untethered.
Yeah, I think continuing in that paragraph that you read first, just worth noting, like you mentioned, it's actually here that Faramir says he doesn't love the bright sword for its sharpness, nor the arrow for its swiftness, nor the warrior for his glory. I don't know why I conflated that with his conversation with Eowyn, but he's essentially, I guess I do know why, he's essentially healing her of that kind of mindset and restoring her to loving life. But he says that he wouldn't want the city of the men of Numenor loved in a fearful way. So he says, I would not have her feared, save as men may fear the dignity of a man old and wise. And that just shows that he wants the glory of Minas Tirith to come from the beautiful things and not from their successes in conquest against evil. He wants the evil to be conquested. He wants the evil to be protected against, but he doesn't want the glory of that conquest to be the defining characteristic. He actually wants the defining characteristic to be, as you mentioned, the peace and the fruit that comes from the defeating of evil.
That's right. So returning to Boromir and looking at what he does, he lacks the farsightedness. He lacks the understanding of divine providence. He sees the walking into Mordor as folly. And so he then ultimately tries to take the ring from Frodo. So is this his hour of failure? Would you characterize it as failure? What would you say?
I would say yes, because up to this point, it's obviously been on his mind, particularly once you read the scene, you realize, okay, yeah, this has been here for a while now. He's been growing in his desire to manipulate things however he can such that they land in Gondor, and now he's ready to just take the ring. So in that sense, like Galadriel passes the test when Frodo freely offers the ring, Boromir fails his test. He fails his test because he tries to take the ring from Frodo. And he, again, I love the dialogue. We can't go into it because it's like 3 pages long of a dialogue back and forth between him and Frodo. But it's like he tries every way he can to manipulate Frodo into just agreeing with him now that Gandalf's gone. And he tries every possible, we actually listed several of these on the board today in class. Like he tries every possible rhetorical tactic. He tries to shame him. He tries to actually say, you don't have to be ashamed. You can tell them I took it by force. And so he tries both sides of the same coin within a paragraph or two of one another. He calls into question the wisdom that Frodo has taken hold of from Gandalf and Elrond and Aragorn and others. He tries so many different things to justify what his plan is. He even says, the ring should be mine, right? It should be the men of Numenor's because we're the ones who took it from Sauron in the beginning. Essentially, not just saying again, I want the ring, it should be mine, although that's true. That's what's happening in his heart and mind. He's also making a rhetorical point there that's maybe somewhat valid, right? We defeated Sauron. We should have some serious responsibility and some measure of authority even in addressing how we deal with the ring. The problem is he has been deceived. He has fallen into this idea that we have to just do it by might and by strength and not through divine providence, whereas Aragorn is actually representing the claim of Elendil and Isildur rightly, which is to say, yes, he does have a great responsibility with the ring, and he recognizes it and recognizes that the only hope we have is to send it with Frodo. But yeah, I would say that this is Boromir's failure for that reason, because he doesn't recognize the providence that is guiding Frodo's steps the way that Aragorn and others do. But Aragorn in particular is kind of the contrast for men of Gondor who don't see things the same way.
Yeah. And he's unwilling to recognize that to use it is to fight fire with fire. To use it is to become Mordor. He never gets that. He never sees it. He understands, I think, and repents of his taking of his attempt to take the ring, but he never understands that to use the ring is to become Mordor. It's a wonderful, as you point out there, it's not yours save by unhappy chance. It might have been mine. It should be mine. Give it to me. This progression is wonderful, and that's how our minds think. Right? It could have been mine. It should be mine. I'm going to take it. Give it to me. That's how we justify sin in our hearts. But again, we see mercy in Boromir's story. So he's a tragic hero in that he's destroyed by his own flaw. His pride and his strength end up being the thing that undoes him, except for not. He is spared. And it's a beautiful part of the story, because it could easily have not been this way. He could easily have, there's so many ways that Tolkien could have done it. He could have had him successfully take the ring from Frodo, turn around, fight a bunch of orcs, and then be shot, right? And then they have to reclaim the ring from his body or something like that, right? It could have easily happened that way. But no, Tolkien has him trip over a rock. Right? And fall on his face, right? And then I've never seen this before. It's almost a death and resurrection moment right there. For a while he was still, as if his own curse had struck him, and then suddenly he wept. Like, he has to be struck down, and then Tolkien resurrects him, in a sense, for one last moment of glory, one last opportunity to use his strength for the good of the weak. And so his end is honor, right? And I've talked about this before, but my children cried at Boromir's death. But we had to go over it again and again. And we have gone over it again and again since. No, he died with honor, right? But that was mercy. It wasn't justice. Justice would have had his memory be eternally shamed by his conduct with Frodo. But instead, his end is defined by his conduct with Merry and Pippin.
Yeah, I think we need to just read that that brief account there at the beginning of The Two Towers, the departure of Boromir, because I want to come back to the question as well that you asked at the beginning, which is, why is Boromir here? Why is he put into the party at all? Why this character, you know, why is, again, clearly providence is what's guiding him to Rivendell at the right time. And then Providence bookends the story by tripping him over the rock. And that's what causes him to realize what he's done and to repent and to weep. But let's read it here. This exchange between Boromir and Aragorn is important. A mile maybe from Parth Gallen, in a little glade not far from the lake, he found Boromir. He was sitting with his back to a great tree, as if he was resting. But Aragorn saw that he was pierced with many black-feathered arrows. His sword was still in his hand, but it was broken near the hilt. His horn, cloven in two, was at his side. Many orcs lay slain, piled all about him and at his feet. Aragorn knelt beside him. Boromir opened his eyes and strove to speak. At last, slow words came. "I tried to take the ring from Frodo," he said. "I'm sorry. I have paid." His glance strayed to his fallen enemies. 20 lay there at least. "They have gone. The halflings, the orcs, have taken them. I think they are not dead. Orcs bound them." He paused, and his eyes closed wearily. After a moment, he spoke again. "Farewell, Aragorn. Go to Minas Tirith and save my people. I have failed." "No," said Aragorn, taking his hand and kissing his brow. "You have conquered. Few men have gained such a victory. Be at peace. Minas Tirith shall not fall." Boromir smiled. Which way did they go? Was Frodo there? Said Aragorn. But Boromir did not speak again. So it's hard. It's a hard scene to read, but also really interestingly, I had not thought about this. You know, Boromir, it's almost ironic because he wants glory with the ring. He wants to have something like this on a grander scale with the ring, conquering Sauron, throwing him down at his feet. And yet, even though that wrong desire is what leads to his failure and leads to what we see here, even in his redemption, you actually do get what Boromir wants, which is to protect the good from this great and heroic sacrifice and this great and heroic feat of strength and arms. Because Aragorn, just to maybe put a point on it, Aragorn understands what a great victory looks like for a single combatant. He is an incredible warrior and has lived a very long time among incredible warriors and has fought alongside them. So for him to look around at 20 or more orcs with this one man who's killed them all and to say few have gained such a victory, right? I think just on the physical side of it, the actual combat and the glory of the battle, Aragorn is praising him. But I actually think, tell me what you think about this. I think he's maybe saying even more than that. Few have gained such a victory. I think he's also maybe seeking in some ways to encourage Boromir that he tried to take the ring, but he clearly sees Boromir has died repentant, right? He clearly sees that Boromir has maybe reached out his hand to take it and for whatever reason was unsuccessful, but then chooses at the end not to give in to the desire, not to give in to corruption totally.
No, that's interesting. I have never thought about... I have considered Aragorn's words, few have gained such a victory, as few have been presented with the ring and have not taken it. I have thought about that before, but I've never thought about it in the context of Boromir's repentance. That Boromir is clearly repentant, and that is a victory in itself. So Boromir didn't fail to take the ring because he was virtuous. Boromir failed to take the ring because divine providence put a rock under, under his foot, right? But Boromir was triumphant in repentance. And I've never had those words impressed upon me so much. That's the first and the only thing just about he says to Aragorn. He says, I tried to take the ring from Frodo. I am sorry. I have paid. He understands. He maybe he doesn't understand the grand sweep of things, but he understands that he should not have tried to take the ring. He's repentant. And so I agree with you. I think Aragorn's commendation is not just about his feat of arms, but his repentance. And that's potent.
Maybe, so coming back to the the question that you led with, maybe that's a big part of the reason that Tolkien writes the story this way. He wants to show this particular moment, this particular scene, and more than just in a literary sense. Obviously, this is a beautiful scene for any story to contain, something like this, where you have a character redeemed. But in this particular way, to show Boromir recognizing what was wrong with him the whole time. I actually think, so I would push this maybe against a little bit what you said earlier, that he never realizes to try to take the ring is utterly corrupting and that it turns all things to evil. I actually think this is part of what he is realizing in his repentance, is it turned my desire into something wicked, and it led me to try to betray and take the ring from Frodo and to try to kill him. I mean, he says as much. And so this is his moment of recognizing here at the very end, right? He doesn't say something like, try to get Frodo and make sure the ring goes back to Minas Tirith to protect my people. He tells Aragorn, you go, you protect our people, you save my city. I think recognizing that it is not the part of Frodo and the ring to take that path. That might be reading too much into it, but I think that idea is there, that Boromir is recognizing and coming to grips with the fact that his judgment has been wrong.
Sure. I mean, I would say that's probably, I wouldn't say that myself. I say that's reading too far into it. And I'm not sure it's necessary for his redemption, for him to understand. He is a man of battle, and he needs to do what's set before him to do. And it's not necessary for him to understand, for him to be noble and virtuous. So, I mean, I don't think it's contradictory to say that maybe he gets it at the end. But it's striking that I don't think Tolkien presents him as understanding. It may be. But he does accept, he accepts Aragorn, and he accepts the hope that Aragorn offers. And that lovely final bit, Boromir smiled, right? Aragorn says, "Be at peace. Minas Tirith shall not fall." And Boromir accepts it. And so you see that. Even if he doesn't accept the whole, I don't know. I would argue maybe that he does not get the whole picture of the ring, but he gets Aragorn. And that's sufficient, right? That's sufficient. And I will say, to again, give the movie credit where credit is due, I do think they do the death of Boromir really well. And you do have that same acceptance of Aragorn that is necessary for Boromir's redemption.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's one of the best scenes in the whole trilogy, I would say. And you get to see the fight too, which is great. You know, it's incredible. So one last note there maybe is just saying, I guess if he is repenting for trying to take the ring from Frodo, what is that repentance? If not, I recognize now that I don't need to, like, we don't need to take the ring and use it for this purpose.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I get that. Yeah, I can see that.
Other than just, I mean, he's obviously repenting for the base treachery of the thing, the base kind of betrayal of the thing. It's always read to me as more than that, though, of a kind of, maybe not the whole picture, like you said, but a recognition this was wrong and it was not meant to be that I take the ring and go to Minas Tirith. I think maybe an acceptance of that. And like you said, very importantly, an acceptance of Aragorn as king is so essential to his character, because again, it completes that circle that you see beginning in the Council of Elrond, where he's hoping or maybe doubting, you know, his own lack of hope shows in doubting Aragorn, but wanting it to be true. And now he realizes that it is true, and he trusts Aragorn to save his city.
Yeah. So I agree. Yeah. And wrapping up, I'm going to give a couple of answers to my question that I began with, and I'd love to hear your thoughts, and then we can call it a day. Why does Divine Providence rope Boromir in? What part does he have to play? So I can give a couple of different answers. He was necessary for the company to make it as far as it did, right? They needed his strength. They needed his strength on Caradhras. They needed his wisdom. They needed his strength in battle, that he was necessary for the physical safety of the company. Okay, that's one. Second, in his death, I don't actually think that his, and I've always struggled with this, I've never said this out loud, I don't think that his saving of Merry and Pippin is actually particularly significant. Like, he doesn't actually save them. The orcs take them away anyways, as they always intended to do. So he doesn't prevent harm from coming to Merry and Pippin. That doesn't downplay the nobility of his actions, but that's not his significance there. I don't think. Okay. He also, as we find out later, Faramir wanted to go, and Boromir wouldn't let him. So if for some reason it was important that Boromir go and Faramir not, and that's not hard to see, right? If Faramir is not in Ithilien when Frodo and Sam come, that plays very differently, right? So there's that as well. Boromir going means Faramir is where he is, so that's necessary. Playing even further down the line, if Boromir needed to know Aragorn before he came as king, so it's hard to imagine Boromir, captain of Gondor, being there when Aragorn comes marching into town and that going super well. It's easy to imagine that Boromir's pride getting in the way at that point. Maybe that's stretching things too far. And then also the picture of Boromir's repentance here. It needed his, in some sense, I think that Divine Providence has Boromir come into the quest for the saving of his soul. And that's what we see here. Those are my thoughts.
I think that last point is the strongest, certainly. And what stood out to me is this is the saving of his soul, but also perhaps in some sense an example to the reader and eventually to others. So Aragorn doesn't tell anyone about what Boromir says initially, but later does. So there's maybe an important point there as well, that people do end up learning from his example. It's in the book, after all, that Frodo writes.
Well, Frodo would have known. But Aragorn's not sharing that with Legolas and Gimli is, I think, just a wonderful example of nobility.
Yeah. Importantly, though, Frodo would not have known without Aragorn how Boromir died and that it went well with him. Yeah, that's what I mean. So for Frodo's sake, to hear that is such a relief. That part doesn't explain why he's in the Fellowship. So I also think, and I don't know, maybe this can be last thoughts, but I think there's maybe something going on here with Aragorn and how this is such a motivation for him. I don't know how to put a fine point on that, but it's such a kind of motivating and moving scene for Aragorn to go to Minas Tirith, not to track Frodo, not to track Sam, and go with them into Mordor. Because I believe it's even, maybe a little bit later, or maybe it came a little bit before this, that he's actually, I think it's right after this, that he's actually talking about how he had planned to go with Frodo. But now there's hope that they might be able to save Merry and Pippin. And he says, Boromir laid it on me to go to Minas Tirith, and my heart desires it. But where are the ring and the bearer? How shall I find them and save the quest from disaster? So he's wrestling with that. I think part of Boromir being there is what pushes him to go to Minas Tirith, which again saves the whole thing, because that plays a quintessential role in Frodo and Sam being able to make it in the end. Oddly, it is Aragorn going and becoming a man of war. It is Aragorn going and becoming a king and challenging Sauron outright face to face that allows Frodo and Sam to make it.
No, that's great. It is actually, in a sense, Aragorn taking up Boromir's mantle in a way that ends up saving the day or being critical for the success of the party. And you can overplay that. And I think the movies do overplay it, overplay Aragorn's doubt of himself, his unwillingness to go. I think they do overplay it, but they don't overplay something that's not there. And it's hard to say exactly what part Boromir's charge to Aragorn plays in that, but it's not nothing.
I think in the movie, the difference is his doubt is in his ability. And in the book, his doubt is, I don't want to make the wrong decision, because he recognizes a responsibility for Frodo and Sam. Because interestingly, the line from Arwen, you are Isildur's heir, not Isildur himself. That's actually word for word, but it's Aragorn who says it of himself. And that's the part that you mentioned earlier where he is excusing Boromir, forgiving Boromir for his suspicion. He says, I'm Isildur's heir, not Isildur himself. I don't resemble the great men of the past. So it's not even a negative. He's saying it, it's not even a positive. He's saying it as a negative that, you know, he would want to look like them. He would want to be, you know, like Isildur in that way. And so interesting how they just take that line and totally flip it and mean something almost antithetical to what Aragorn means. But yeah, I think it's not the thing that pushes Aragorn, but I do think it's a significant contributing factor, because now he feels a responsibility to stand by Boromir's sacrifice and to stand by the people of Gondor and not go in search of Frodo and Sam. Whereas I could very easily see him choosing that, even choosing to split up from Gimli and Legolas and potentially encouraging them to go and to pursue Merry and Pippin. And then go with Frodo himself. Yeah.
No, I think you're right. Good stuff, man. Good stuff, man. I hate to cut it off, but we probably should wrap up.
Yeah, I think we've gone over time. So let's get some book recommendations. What do you have for us this week?
Mine is very incongruous with this subject, but that's all right. It is We Have No Idea by Daniel Whiteson and Jorge Cham. And it is a wonderful, wonderful look at modern physics. And it's whimsical. One of the guys, I forget which one, one of them is a physicist. The other one is a cartoonist. They are basically tackling modern physics from the standpoint of all of the questions that we do not have answers to right now. And it's just delightful. It presents the scientific enterprise in a wonderful light because it presents both how much we have figured out and how much we have no idea about. I highly recommend it to anyone just wanting kind of a surface level understanding of where modern physics is and how little it knows, which is good. Maybe here's the tie-in. It's good to avoid hubris. There you are. We Have No Idea, Cham and Whiteson.
And maybe on a similar note, actually, I had not considered this, but my book for this week is Frankenstein by Mary Shelley. And it's, among other things, all about ambition and the peril of ambition and how it leads you to doing just this, to sacrificing the good in pursuit of greatness, in pursuit of some victory that you perceive. So you have Frankenstein's pursuit of controlling life itself. And he's to do that, he has to dig up these corpses and desecrate tombs and sew these different bodies together. And it's a compelling frame story because he's telling his story to another character in the book to stop him from doing this ambitious thing that's going to get all of his men killed. He's an explorer near the North Pole, and he's giving him a warning about ambition and how it has destroyed his life and it's led to the ruin of everyone he loves. So a great picture of maybe in some sense where Boromir could have gone and what could have happened in his character through pride, hubris, ambition, vanity, wanting to achieve greatness for yourself no matter the cost. And on that note, we hope that you've enjoyed the episode. Thanks for joining us. If you would like to follow what we have been writing about, you can see a link to our Substack in the description below. You can also see a link to Shane Caver's music. We want to say thank you to Shane for the use of our theme music for the show. And we also want to thank ETC Media. They have joined on as editors for the podcast, so they've been helping us quite a bit. And if you have any needs regarding photography or video editing, podcast production, as it turns out, or any such things, feel free to give them a look. They've been great to work with us and have been very helpful. So thank you to ETC Media as well. And with that, we hope you've been blessed and edified by the show.
Don't be hasty.
My name is Jameson Winter, and I'm the dean of the upper...
They already know that.
That's true.
Okay. Sorry, go on.
I'm the dean of...
You can cut that if you want to. I couldn't resist.